Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Well, thanks for coming along tonight. It's a very busy time, so it's appreciated that you're here. Speaking tonight is Margie Osman, who I'll introduce briefly. She's well known to many of you for activities around New South Wales and Sydney, and also nationally. She's CEO of the Australian National Retailers Association and a former CEO of the State Chamber of Commerce in New South Wales. She's on the board of the Bell Shakespeare Company, and also chairman of the board of the International World Masters Games. And I can see many of you are in training, doing your stretches and all that. What is it, October? Yeah, so if I occasionally do a handstand tonight, you'll understand it's not that I've lost attention, it's just that I'm stretching out. And of course, retail is a very important segment in the Australian economy, and tonight Margie Osman is going to talk for us about what's happening to retail. Margie, you're very welcome.
Thank you very much for that introduction, Jared, and I'd like to assure you that your registration form for the World Masters Games will be winging its way to you. I can find a sport for you, dog walking or not. So, well, I'd have to start tonight by saying that the retail sector is a very interesting beast. We were having a discussion in our office recently trying to figure out what was possibly the first point of commercial exchange, and the only thing we could agree on was that it probably happened in a cave somewhere. Whatever it was, we've clearly come a very long way from the days when a few arrowheads were exchanged for a new skin to update the stylish caveman or cavewoman's winter wardrobe. It now represents the largest employment sector, with over 1.5 million Australians finding a job in the retail ranks. It can also lay claim to being the training base of the nation. Now, before I go any further, I would like to try an experiment, and I want to see a show of hands, so there's a little bit of exercising going to happen here. I'd like to know how many of you in the room had your first job in a shop. And I'm going to start by confessing mine was in DJs in the frock department. Excellent. Fabulous. Now, I would have to say that you're members of a very impressive alumni. You're in very good company. Julia Gillard tells me that her first job was in Katie's. Kevin Rudd's first job was in a shopping mall. And Malcolm Turnbull, I think, has alluded to the fact that he worked in the vegetable markets as a young man. So retail is that incubator that gets all the kids ready for the workforce. And at the other end of the spectrum now, increasingly it is the hope of a much older population who are looking to re-enter the workforce. Stores like Bunnings, for example, will tell you that increasingly as super nest eggs have been damaged and times have become tough, people in their 60s are looking for jobs in retail. Many tradies, for example, feeling the strain of too many years of physical labour, are changing jobs and adding their expertise to the appeal of a wander through Bunnings on a Sunday morning. Although I'm sure most men don't need any encouragement for a bit of hardware therapy. The last 12 months have really turned a spotlight on the retail sector as the critical barometer of consumer confidence and an indicator of the state of what Keynes calls animal spirits. So after what can only be described as a very difficult 12 or 18 months in the sector, I'd like to talk a little bit about where we're sitting at the moment and what we think of the implications and outcomes that are likely in the next 12 months. If we look back over the last year, there is no doubt at all the financial figures tell a very sobering story. The retail slide began early last year. Soaring fuel prices and rising interest rate had consumers pressing the brakes big time, directly after Christmas 2007. Our own consumer surveys at ANRA detected early signs of a real reining in and a return to cocooning and staying at home. So by the time the Aussie airwaves started carrying the messages of unemployment and financial collapse in the United States, wallets were already snapping shut all over the country. At the same time, retail unemployment was rising. A massive 60,000 full-time jobs were lost in the 12 months up to February of this year. Now, to be fair, there were 47,000 part-time jobs created in the same period of time. But this news went largely unnoticed by the media and by politicians. The retail turnover results speak for themselves. 2008 was the worst year for retailers since 2000. Sales grew by a meagre 0.6%, well below the average 3.4%. In September, the collapse of the fabulously named Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac and subsequent talk of rising unemployment in the United States brought home the very real prospect that Australia could enter a recession. Now, that didn't take very long to reverberate through the malls of Australia, and retailers felt a dip and a chill pretty quickly. People were still looking, but they weren't buying. And if they were, they were making what we have now learnt to call value purchases. And they became very reluctant to go too far from home, too. International travel fell sharply, and credit card use also dropped significantly. Instead of pulling out the credit card, we switched to debit cards and cash, and we opted to spend money we knew we had. The mega toy sales that are now traditionally held in June and July, and anybody here that has kids or grandkids will know all about those sales, has interestingly enough seen an enormous rebirth of the lay-by, of all things. As families planned for Christmas 2008 expenses, they bought in June to make sure the trees would be stocked with gifts that they had paid off over months and could therefore afford. Then in October, the Prime Minister and the Treasurer rode in on their white horses with bags of cash, trusting that the stimulus packages would keep the cash registers ticking over, and there is no doubt that that's exactly what he did. Coupled with falling interest rates, consumers were encouraged to come out of their cautious shell and look at the bargains that surrounded them, and there is no doubt at all there were bargains to be had. So it became a buyer's market in that end of the year period, as very reluctant Australian shoppers took their pick and picked up bargain after bargain after bargain, and sales abounded. Consumers were bombarded with two-for-one offers, day-only sales, half-price sales, guerrilla sales, and endless clearances. Sales became the norm and are now the norm. Consumers who have never haggled began to haggle with the best of them, and I think in the last 12 months we have heard more often than ever before, what is your best price for cash? Over the period of 5 months, over the Christmas period and into the early part of this year, we monitored consumer spending intentions and found that one in two spent their hand out. The government's generosity was definitely finding its way into the retail tills. Sales bounced in December last year by a massive 3.8%, the largest monthly rise in 8 years. Over the year to June retail sales volumes have been up 4.1%. We estimate that about $4.5 billion, or a fifth of the two cash handouts, which were worth about $20 billion, has been injected into the retail sector since December last year. Now, however, 8 months after, the stimulus effect is beginning to fade. In the June month alone, retail sales dropped by 1.4%. New South Wales, believe it or not, was the only state in Australia in positive retail territory. Just, but nevertheless, in positive territory. Modelling by Access Economics forecasts that retail sales will fall by 0.3% in 2009-10 before moving back into the black at just 0.1% in 2010-11. So, it's now all eyes on the months to come. There are some promising signs of recovery. Unemployment has not risen as sharply as expected, and consumer confidence appears to be turning. The Westpac Melbourne Institute Consumer Sentiment Index, which is a mouthful, has risen towards a two-year high. Now, some economists say, as far as consumers are concerned, the worst of the downturn is now behind us. However, there isn't actually any lasting evidence of a strong recovery. It still remains to be seen. Not that I wish to be doom and gloom, but I think there is a need for some realism. We are, of course, in the throes of the annual battle of the fashion parades, and you could be forgiven for seeing all of that strutting glamour and thinking that a recovery is only the swipe of a credit card away. However, the downturn could be a V-shaped dip, or it could be a bathtub-shaped dip, or it could be a W-shaped dip that has a peak in the middle for Christmas. We don't know, and we're just going to have to watch and wait. We are not expecting to see a broad pickup in retail turnover until Christmas, and we will once again be at the mercy of the unemployment figures. The Reserve Bank has a very difficult balancing act to manage, and they are watching our much-discussed animal spirits very closely. With the prospect of the next interest rate movement, the Reserve Bank has to be concerned about choking off confidence, that fragile, much-discussed and overused green shoot. So while we balance as retailers on the high wire recovery or not, what have we actually learnt in the last year, and what do we think the long-term effects, the spin-off of that 2008 significant loss in confidence is going to be for both retailers and consumers alike? So, the first of the trends. One thing is certain, that there's been a dramatic move towards value. Australian consumers are now utterly value-driven, and for retailers this means even more pressure to keep costs under control. Dr. Ira Kalish from Deloitte's research department says, as we move through 2009, we are going to see consumers shift to more price-focused and value-oriented retailers. And we're already seeing in the big retailers a very significant swing to home brands of all kinds. The truly massive line to enter the new Costco store in Melbourne is testament to just how interested people are in a different kind of shopping. And as somebody who went to the VIP opening of Costco in Melbourne, I don't know if anybody here has experienced Costco, but it is extraordinary. Consumers began queuing as early as 4 a.m. last Monday morning outside the first Australian store. And upon entering, and I can attest to this, they were confronted with the most diverse possible range of products, from digital grand pianos right through to bikes, vacuum cleaners, clothes, grocery items, cooked chooks, jewellery, Versace dinnerware, you name it. So this is a new way of shopping, and certainly Melburnians appear to be embracing it. I have heard it described as a treasure hunt, shopping in a Costco store. Part of their model is to make sure that it changes constantly and is always surprising. Definitely that. Aldi, of course, is a slightly different model, but is also about very basic necessities, very cheap prices, and it's certainly reaping the benefits of its establishment here in Australia. The German retailer plans to have 700 stores in Australia, placing it on an even footing with Coles and Woolworths, who have between 700 and 800 stores each. Probably the next trend is a thing we've been calling home is where the heart is, and it's definitely been the theme of the last year. Cocooning, spending on the home, in the home, and home-based entertaining has seen the rise and rise and rise and rise of the plasma screen in the last 18 months. Supported by the stimulus package, Australians went out and did their patriotic duty and bought electronics. I think Harvey Norman and JB Hi-Fi most definitely have Kevin and Wayne on their Christmas card list now. Trends in sales. I've also told some interesting stories about how consumers were actually feeling, what they were thinking. Booksellers have done very well in this period, and I for one think a book is a real value-packed form of entertainment, and quite clearly lots of other Australians think so too. And in case you're curious, I am told that romance was the major winning category. And Don Grover, the CEO of Dimmicks, tells me that the fastest growing category is actually vampire and supernatural romance. And I'm just going to leave that completely to your imagination. I'm not going to speculate there at all. Cookbooks were booming in the early part of the year too, which was supporting another trend we were seeing very strongly, which is the amazing strength of the food sector during this period. Families stayed close to home, they entertained the family at a barbie as opposed to necessarily going out for dinner. Generation XY discovered this unused room in the house that's called a kitchen that they'd never really seen before or understood. And quite clearly, the success of TV's MasterChef can now be laid firmly at the door of the global financial crisis, because otherwise XY wouldn't have known what a kitchen was. You only have to look at the most recent figures for Coles and Woolies to see just how strong that sector's been and how well they have performed. So probably the next important trend is actually about how people have been spending. Increasingly, they're taking a very careful approach to spending on their credit cards particularly. They have paid off the card as far as possible. They've concentrated on creating a buffer for their mortgage, so they put away whatever money they could. Certainly as part of our surveying, people were telling us that when the interest rates drop, they continue to pay their mortgages at the higher level quite deliberately. In fact, the household saving ratio has more than doubled in the last 6 months of 2008, and it's at the highest level, in fact, in that period of 2008 that we've seen since the last recession. Figures from the Reserve Bank earlier this month confirm that this trend is actually continuing. EFTPOS and debit card purchases are up 17% on a year ago, and credit card usage has shrunk by 11%. So you're definitely seeing a change in how comfortable people are to be in debt. I'd like to go back to the animal spirits idea for our next trend for a moment. While we're all out there polishing up our crystal balls and looking at what might be a recovery, it's worth noting that Generation X and Y, this is their first brush with anything that looks, sounds or smells like a recession or a downturn. They've never seen one before. And I think we're a long way from actually understanding the lasting effect of what that fright may be for that sector of the community. And once again, jobs will be the critical issue for them. Why don't I move away from the trends and perhaps talk a little bit about what the roadblocks might be to recovery for the retail sector particularly. The spectre of rising interest rates has got to soon start having an unsettling effect. Just the mere mention of an increase in rates will have some impact on spending. Over the last 12 months, many consumers have admittedly given themselves a mortgage buffer, but that prospect of higher rates is going to start impacting significantly soon, and unfortunately, the place that will feel the brunt most is New South Wales. Confidence will take a hit, and those savvy enough to understand what is going on will know that there is unlikely to be any further cash handouts. Jobs are going to be the centre of attention over the next 12 months, and well, they should be. At a time when the capacity to retain and create jobs is pivotal to our capacity to follow those first green shoots, you would think that the biggest employers in the country would be worth listening to. When we sounded the warning on award modernisation, the government seemed to be listening, but there hasn't actually been a great deal of action. The task of producing 100 outdated awards into one is no easy feat, and we freely admit that, and applaud the intent of harmonisation. I'm sure everybody would. But the federal government made a commitment that the reform would not mean higher employment costs. Clearly, this is not going to be the case. In January next year, retail employer costs are going to skyrocket. And that is no exaggeration, despite the fact that Joe De Bruin from the largest union in the sector described my comments on this as, you know, talking about peanuts the other day. The new award will add hundreds of millions of dollars to labour costs with no productivity savings at all. On Sundays alone, higher penalty rates will cost retailers an extra $100 million a year. And New South Wales, once again, will be shouldering the lion's share of that because two-thirds of the retail employees are here. Retailers will be left with one of two decisions, either cut hours and jobs or put prices up. And neither of those options are palatable at all at this point in time. Now, I think probably you'd all agree with me that retailing is a 24/7 business. Shops need to be open when consumers want to shop, and that means Sundays now in the 21st century. Given the immediate future facing the retail sector, it's still largely unknown what's going to happen over the next 12 months. We are and have for some time been urging the government to grant a two-year moratorium on the award modernisation changes for the retail sector particularly. I mean, even the Fair Pay Commission recognised how volatile the employment situation was and is, deciding in July this year to leave the minimum wage unchanged. It therefore seems counterintuitive for the federal government to push ahead with new costs in just 4 months' time. The federal government is certainly aware of our concerns, but there are still no signs that the largest and potentially most vulnerable employment sector will have the support it needs to protect Australian jobs. As the biggest employers of young people and women, these groups are going to feel an unreasonable impact from any impact on this particular sector. We certainly hope the government's going to act soon because time is clearly running out. What also needs to be remembered in this debate is that Australians want to shop in a different way than they did, the way they did in the 60s and 70s. Supermarkets' busiest shopping days are now Saturday and Sunday and Thursday and Friday after 5 p.m. And despite what you might hear, there is absolutely no shortage of people willing to work during those times. In the light of this changed retail landscape, in the course of their enterprise bargaining agreements, many of the large retailers have already paid out the penalty rate, so that the average worker is getting much better than the award and has done for some time. For some of our members, for example, at ANRA, these EBAs happened 10 or 15 years ago. In South Australia, the new award that's being proposed by the Industrial Relations Commission will reintroduce penalty rates. These were cashed out some time ago in South Australia, so we're going to have double dipping in that state. For Woolworths, Let's just take a couple of the really big guys. For Woolworths, they estimate the new award will cost them 1,000 jobs. Coles expects it to put in jeopardy another 1,000 part-time and casual jobs. And that's just the food retailing sector. You know, this is the tip of the iceberg, and I say to you, it is most definitely not peanuts. Small employers who have even less capacity to absorb these extra costs are going to be in diabolical trouble and hugely disadvantaged. We continue to be in discussions with the Deputy Prime Minister, and very happy to be so, but we want to see how those jobs can be protected, and we continue to hope that there will be a positive outcome in that space. While the retail sector has been experiencing buoyant times with the stimulus package, we're starting to see that wash right out of the economy now, and the prospects for the next 12 months are pretty flat. This is not a good time to be applying extra costs to the retail sector. The federal government needs to step in and protect retail jobs. I'd like to move on to what we see as another pretty significant barrier that is in some way linked to that earlier discussion about award modernisation, and it's that one that just doesn't go away: trading hours. Retailing, at least I think, is all about convenience, something that seems to have escaped your average politician. Most of us are juggling work and family and other commitments, so time is really increasingly precious. So we want to shop when it's convenient to us, I think. While massive inroads have been made into this deregulation space in the ACT and the Northern Territory and Tasmania, many states are actually yet to wake up and notice the fact that it's the 21st century, particularly South Australia and Western Australia. Just last week, the West Australian Labor Party caucus decided that they would vote against a bill that would level the playing field in Perth metropolitan areas and allow all retailers to be open to 9 p.m. on weeknights. Doesn't seem like such a terribly big ask, does it? Labor has denied shoppers the choice now. Lower prices and new retail jobs are going to disappear, and they've condemned Perth shoppers to a last-minute scramble to do the grocery shopping and the near impossibility of shopping as a family as a result. The blame, of course, should be equally aimed at the independent grocers who claim to be the local heroes, who currently enjoy extended weekday trading. While the local Coles and Woolworths in Perth have to close their doors at 6 p.m, the IG-owned independents can trade right up until 10 p.m. Hardly an even playing field, I would have thought. And if you follow the WA Labor argument that nobody wants to shop on a weeknight anyway, why are the independents open until 9 o'clock then? Our survey of 500 Perth residents found that 80% of people aged between 25 and 44 wanted extended trading hours. It's not really rocket science. An overwhelming amount of evidence shows that if you deregulate trading hours, allowing businesses to serve their customers when it suits both parties, you increase competition and you help to bring down prices. And that, after all, is what we all want. You just have to look at the Eastern Seaboard, which I know is not a popular direction to look if you happen to live in WA, but as I mentioned earlier, Aldi plans to have 700 stores in Australia. Costco has opened its first store in Melbourne just a few weeks ago. This is clear evidence of competition. Anyway, we still have some way to go in WA. Sunday is regarded by consumers now as just another business day. Retail figures show that up to 20% of weekly trading volume occurs on a Sunday, and yet in places like Perth, retailers are forced to close. One other thought on the subject of Perth, because I can't resist it. When I was preparing this speech, I did a little bit of Google work, as you do, you know, go for a bit of a wander about on the internet, because I was looking for some material on the history of shopping. When I put shopping and the Dark Ages into the search engine, the first few pages that came back were all stories about trading hours in Western Australia. And for the record, in the real Dark Ages, they did have extended trading hours because the shops opened with the first Angelus bell at 5 a.m. in the morning in major cities. So that's not a good look for WA. So with the exception of specified public holidays, we support what customers want: the removal of all trading hour restrictions, and we'll continue to battle on. Another looming battle is the horror story, which is the planning regime in so many parts of Australia, and this definitely falls into the category of a major barrier to competition and entry. There is a strong desire, I will admit, in the Department of Planning in this state to create more jobs, and they've been very aware that planning restrictions are a problem, and I think are making some progress. However, it can take up to 8 years between identifying the need for a new store and the moment the first customer walks through the door. 8 years. The process is even tougher in what the industry call infill locations, where the zoning has already been decided. It's easier, I suppose, to a degree, depending upon your definition of easy, in newly developed areas, but it is those infill locations which are particularly difficult. A report by the Urban Task Force last year found that Sydney alone will need 50% more retail space over the next 25 years. A 10% increase in retail floor space would result in 16,500 jobs in metropolitan Sydney alone. But getting that extra space will prove difficult, especially with the local planning restrictions as they stand. Just last week we heard about the battle between retailers and councils over store proposals in Pennant Hills, Bankstown and Windsor. You know, you can't have it both ways. If the issue here is better competition and lower prices, and that means there needs to be more players in the marketplace, you've got to relax the planning restrictions. So as more players with different store layouts and designs enter the market, this is all going to continue to be a problem. The ACCC found in its report on grocery price competitiveness last year that council zonings and planning laws were preventing new supermarkets from opening. What needs to be remembered is retailers would only be opening new stores if there was a demand for it. They understand their business and their customers and know what they want. We run the real risk of stifling competition for the sake of a few vocal opponents and denying ourselves that downward pressure on prices and the choice that all Australian consumers are entitled to. I have to give some credit to the federal government in this state, in this place, because they are attempting to reduce the barriers to entry. In April last year, the government extended the time frame for the development of vacant commercial land from 12 months to 5 years to help new players like Aldi. So credit where credit's due, but planning reform will be the new battlefield, and that's certainly the precedent that we've seen in this competition space in the UK. So, pushing on from the day-to-day issues of planning and trading hours, not to mention things like creeping acquisitions and grocery choice, let's take a look at the longer term and what the future might hold for Australian consumers and retailers alike, beyond the financial woes. Let's just have a look at the future. There are some really interesting bigger picture trends to be looked forward to. We are incredibly time poor as a community now and technology rich. And as consumers, we're looking for experiences as well as convenience. So supermarkets and specialty retailers already have self-checkouts, so self-scanners, for those of you who are very keen do-it-yourselfers. I have to confess I'm one of the old-fashioned ones that still goes through the ordinary checkout. Consumers can swipe and pay for petrol without entering a petrol station now. Twitter, Facebook, MySpace, Flickr, LinkedIn, YouTube are as much a part of our vocabulary as Google. We are increasingly in touch with friends and businesses at the click of a mouse or the roll of a thumb on the screen over your iPhone. Research from Google has found that half of Australia's shoppers search online now before purchasing, and the internet is now more important than any other kind of advertising. So they may still go into the store to buy, but they do their homework on the internet. We are increasingly entering stores with more information about the type of product we want to purchase, which has huge implications for retailers and their staff and how they service those customers and the expectations of those customers. Just last week, the Australian Centre for Retail Studies released a report which warned that a surge in online trading could mean the closure of many smaller retailers. And certainly, once again, that's a trend that we're already seeing in the UK and the US. Let's talk about some of the gadgets that you're soon going to be able to access. There are transmitters on products that are going to communicate with your phone. So, for example, if you go to the store and you pick up a dress off the stand, it's going to communicate back to you and say, you picked up this dress? Well, we think this pair of shoes, that hat and that scarf goes with it. So would you like to go over there and pick those things up and take them all into the changing room with you? There are trials afoot already in the UK, in Sainsbury's and other places, to have groceries that are going to talk to you. Your groceries will have special scanning capacity on them, so you can run your phone over the grocery and it will tell you where it was made, what it's made out of, and potentially how you could cook it and what the recipe might look like. Tesco expects to be providing mortgages in the UK by the end of 2010, and that brand is simply expanding in so many directions. It's really no longer about the length of the hem or the best coffee. It's about understanding what your consumer's lifestyle is and being actually relevant and tapping into what their demands are. Let me give you another example. McDonald's now offers free wireless to all of their customers. So instead of just dropping in for a takeaway coffee, Generation Y is going in with their laptop, they're having something to eat, and they're doing their study for university or wherever else it might be at McDonald's instead of some corner cafe. In Germany now, retailers are actually designing special geriatric supermarkets with, amongst other things, wider aisles and massages in the checkout queues, and I'm all for that. I understand that Tesco is also looking at this space and have been taking test groups from the UK to Germany to try it out. Even today, you may have seen your papers, and for my sins, I had to do some media on this earlier today, Buttcam, which is to help female shoppers answer that age-old question that most men are too afraid to answer, about what does my backside really look like in this? It's a jeans company that will now allow you to take a photograph of your bottom in the new pair of jeans and decide whether you actually like the look of it. I'm not commenting any further than that. In the UK, it's now possible to shop for clothes with an avatar of your own online that has your measurements. So your perfectly shaped to you avatar will go into the online shop, try on the garment, and you will be able to see what it looks like on a body your size and shape, as opposed to heading for the high street to buy it. In Denmark, shoppers in IKEA have a new option for bringing home their purchases. Market research told IKEA that something like 20% of their customers rode their bikes to the store and had no way of taking things home. So they did a deal with a trailer company that now supplies them with special trailers designed for push bikes, so that you can go to IKEA, pick up your goods, put them in the trailer and bike them home with you. So this is really a reflection of how incredibly ego-driven their customers are and how they are responding to it and adding materially to the value of their own brand, as well as making themselves a group of loyal customers. Tesco's, once again, is so conscious of its carbon footprint that it actually has cattle fitted with what are called rumination collars, and this measures the level of belching that an average cow will do, so that when you buy your meat, they can tell you what the carbon footprint is for that from, you know, the moment it's a cow to the moment it's a steak on the plate. Asda a few months ago actually announced that it was launching a special version of low carbon beef, so you can make that choice when you go into the supermarket. So there is a wealth of excitement waiting for all of us in what modern retail is likely to show us in this country. And knowing Australians' propensity for gadgets and technology, I can only imagine we have a great deal to look forward to. Retail is a very dynamic sector and it touches the everyday lives of all of us. It's filled with surprises and possibilities, and even in the toughest times over the last few years, parts of the sector have done well and managed to create jobs. It is the backbone of the employment market and really plays an incredibly vital role in regional communities. It's one of the very few sectors that provides jobs to young people in regional communities. It's the sector that literally has its finger on the pulse of consumer confidence and the feeling of the ordinary citizen, and that knowledge has never been as important as it is right now. The future landscape will be a very challenging one, with a range of outstanding government reforms, which we're not quite certain where they'll end, an economy not yet out of its sick bed, and of course the prospect of an election. Elections have a slowdown effect on spending. People tend to hold off major purchases until they actually have the result of an election. So this will be a very critical timing issue for us. I have a sneaking suspicion it may not necessarily play a large part in Kevin Rudd's decision on when he puts it in, but you know, I have to say it does have an effect. We have to hope that in the next 12 or so months for this election that Australian consumers will in fact follow Imelda Marcos's advice. And you have to admit she is a genuine, or was a very genuine, shopping phenomenon. Imelda suggested that win or lose, after an election, we all go shopping. So thank you all very much.
Thanks, Margie, and thanks to CAWS for the use of this fine facility this evening. I did have my first job in a bookshop, but not in the romance section. I don't think we had a romance. If we did, I didn't see it. So we've got till no later than 7, probably finish a bit before then, but what you painted for, you know, what's obviously a very important section of the economy, really, when you trail through it, is a substantial increase in regulation, and the award modernisation being essentially federal awards impacting on state awards coming out of the federal government in Canberra. Shopping hours restrictions in Western Australia, South Australia coming out of state governments, or the inability of state governments to change laws, as in Western Australia with the new government there. And planning, you mentioned here, New South Wales planning problems, which essentially emanate from state and local government. So do you think this is a scenario of what we're going to cop in the next few years? It seems to be quite a lot of either the maintenance of regulation there or an increase in regulation there.
Certainly one of the promises of the Rudd government was that there would be massive deregulation and everything would be wonderfully harmonised. Yet to see it. Look, you have to applaud the baseline that says let's harmonise all of those awards in different parts of the country. The problem is that the Industrial Relations Commission decided to adopt as their benchmark the Victorian award, which has the highest penalty rates and level of red tape of any of the awards. So in other words, it's the worst possible choice. In terms of the larger issue of regulation across the board, you know, if you talk to, say, our hardware members, for example, this is a serious piece of trivia, but the minimum allowed aperture for a hose, a garden hose, in every state in the country is different, because different environment departments think differently about how big that hose should or should not be. Can you imagine how difficult that is for the Bunnings of this world, and possibly soon to be the Woolworths of this world, as per today's announcement? So we don't see any great hope at this point in time in terms of massive deregulation. In terms of planning, COAG have already entered the race on planning and are attempting to focus that government's attention on it, so we'll just have to hope like heck that something meaningful happens there. I think the other thing that is a little scary about this process is that we are about to go into an election. We don't know a great deal about what the reform agenda for a returned Rudd government would be, and it is likely to be a returned Rudd government, I think. And we're now ourselves looking at the UK as an example of the kind of reform packages that came in the second term of the Blair government to give some kind of heads up on what's likely to happen. And it is an even greater concentration on competition, and the introduction of all kinds of different ombudsmen to watch over everything and it's nanny state central.
So,
I enjoyed the last bit of your talking about value proposition, but I'm also thinking about recycling and packaging and
things. Yeah. Absolutely. All the big retailers in the country are now members of what's called the National Packaging Covenant, which deals specifically with that and has a whole range of requirements on them in terms of delivering on waste management programs and packaging programs. So that's probably number one as a baseline. I think from a practicality point of view, like all of their quite large relatives in different parts of the world, our retailers here understand they have a corporate social responsibility. And certainly, in my experience of our members, they take that incredibly seriously. People like Woolies have, you know, just built a new distribution centre in Victoria, and at considerable expense, the entire roof is fitted to make it possible for solar arrays and solar panel arrays and water capture. If you look at somebody like McDonald's, the franchising requirements for anybody who takes on board a McDonald's now in terms of the need to have water-sensitive plants in the garden all the way through to how to manage their oil disposal and things like that is incredibly onerous, but they see that as really appropriate. So I suppose the short answer to your question is that it has an enormous impact on this sector because from a corporate social responsibility point of view, they think they should be doing it. And in addition to that, because it's what customers expect of them. I mean, if you look particularly in the food and grocery sector and beyond the carbon-friendly beef and the Welch measurement, there is so much stuff now that's available that's organic, that's you know, really clearly discussed in terms of where it came from and what you can expect from it. So I think it's a trend going forward. We're going to see more rather than less of it, but I think you can be comforted that Australian retailers are really on to this one now.
I was just wondering about the payroll tax effect.
Payroll tax is a state tax, and it is a state deeply and profoundly beloved of state treasury departments. We suggested before the last set of stimulus packages came out and masses of cash flushed through the system, which is terrific, but we said at the time that unless you are serious about assisting employers to feel that they can keep jobs in place, you're not doing the job properly. And we suggested to them that if in every state of the country they lowered the payroll tax level to a uniform 4%, didn't dicker with the thresholds too hard, but just take it down to 4% for everyone, the total cost would have been about $4.1 billion. Federal government could have picked up half of it, and the states themselves could have picked up the remainder as it applied to each state. It was a fairly negligible cost. Here in New South Wales, it would have been something like $400 or $500 million, maybe a bit more than that, $600 million. Out of that, what you would have had was employers looking forward over the next 2 years. We said tax holiday for 2 years, not permanent. If you did that for the next 2 years, the employers who might have got to this point in the year and said, my goodness, it's tough, they would have said, you know, I've got this tax holiday on payroll tax. I can keep those two people in their jobs because I know I'm going to get this rebate on my payroll tax over the next 2 years. By ignoring the suggestion, they've denied those employers, particularly smaller employers or medium-sized employers, the opportunity to make that decision. I think it's outrageous, but I have to say to you that payroll tax isn't going anywhere because it's about the only tax that states can levy.
You mentioned in passing that the internet shopping is having an impact on small retailers. Well, you didn't comment on what the major Australian retailers are doing in the face of...
I have to be honest and say there's a reason that I haven't commented on that, and that's because much of that information is simply not available. For the retailers in this country, I think you'll find that they're now beginning to focus very much on the internet part of their business, and what they choose and may do is now very much commercial in confidence. So it's not a great deal of discussion, but I would expect that probably in the next 12 months we're going to see a range of changes and announcements from a whole lot of different retail organisations. I wish I could give you more information than that, but it is quite simply a commercial issue.
What impact does telemarketing and online retailing had in assisting smaller wine producers to compete with major chains, if any?
Yeah, I would have to start up my response to that by saying I don't actually, even though some of my members are liquor retailers, I don't actually represent that part of their business. So I won't pretend to be as across it as I might. Suffice it to say that I'm advised by my members that in December of this year they had the best sales of French champagne they've ever seen. I don't know whether that was the last hurrah of everything. It's going to be such a bad year, let's buy now. I think for most of our big guys, they would be involved in online sort of sales of wine and spirits and so forth as well. I can't give you a definitive answer on that, I'm sorry, but I know that they have been having a very good year in that space.
Just a question about the introduction of unit pricing so far, not yet. Is there any feedback from Winston Poles, where it's the more expensive to achieve the brands within your offering?
I think it's too early to be able to give you anything definitive on that. I think the important thing is that unit pricing has been universally adopted by all of the big guys. It's in place now. What's really driving an interest in home brands is, I think, this flight to value that we've been seeing over the last 12 months in particular. And the thing is now that the whole home brand sector is such a complex one with so many different levels of home brand within that. But I think people are perceiving if they move to the home brand, they've got more options in a value. So we're seeing a movement to that space, in many cases, away from the big brands. But I don't know that it would be. It's not unit pricing, certainly, that we're getting the impression is driving that. It's simply a flight to what they perceive as value, which is going into that home brand space.
I'm coming to the end. Down the back, and then...
Sorry, just backing up the point made here about consumerism and climate change and all the rest of it. How do you balance that against value? Because it's much cheaper to get things made in China, manufacturing, particularly clothing, retail, offshore. That has, apart from the social costs of manufacturing, transport costs and carbon, the effect of that. but there's not much being said about that. Do you think tonight, will they still go for the cheapest, or will they go for things that have less carbon footprint and maybe create jobs in Australia?
I think probably the answer to that is that in most instances, they're probably going to go for the cheapest option. Probably the difference in that space is going to be in the food sector. The vast bulk of what you buy in the big supermarkets is actually sourced here in Australia. Despite, you know, some of the propaganda here, it is actually local produce. And the only time you don't have local produce in those major supermarkets is when our growers can get such good prices overseas that there isn't enough to be had locally. I don't think we're at the point where shoppers are in the majority making a decision based on where it's made. That may come, but that's not necessarily the space now. I think the issue for big retailers is to make sure that they're giving people an option so that consumers can in fact make that choice. That's the critical issue here. It's the ability to have the choice so that you as a consumer have the option of maybe paying a little more for the local product because that's what you feel is important. And equally, the retailer's giving you that opportunity to do that because they think that's important.
Just before I do, you haven't mentioned unfair dismissal as a disincentive for employment. Is that because you essentially represent larger businesses who are always being covered? So just give us a rundown of what you do represent in your association.
Oh, okay. The Australian National Retailers Association, and I have to cheerfully admit here that it's a bit of a crowded space for associations in the retail sector. There are three of us. But my organisation only represents retailers with an annual turnover in excess of $100 million and a national presence. So my board is chaired by Michael Luscombe from Woolies. Mark McGuinness is the deputy chair from David Jones. Ian McLeod, the CEO of Coles, sits on my board, as does Katie Page, the head of Harvey Norman, the head of Bunnings and the head of Best & Less. So while our membership is large retailers, we have an understanding of the wider sector quite clearly. From an employment point of view, I think part of the issue here is that most of the big retailers have had agreements, union negotiated agreements for a very, 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 very long time. And they have paid well above the award for a very long time as well. So I think it would be fair to say that it's a pretty stable workforce that at the top end of the tree, they are employers of choice.
So we go here and go to Jenny. Yeah?
Do you see selling, shopping, retailing to be totally into malls now that the trend is away from the little high street shop? There are no local butchers, no local hardware stores. Bunnings has taken over everything and Coles and food meat. It's just impossible to have a little shop now on the high street sort of.
Isn't that funny? Because I live in Elizabeth Bay, which is just near King's Cross, and I have both options. I have a high street with lots of little shops in it, and gourmet and butchers and gourmet fruit shops and goodness knows what else, as well as having a Woolies and a Coles and whatever else. I think this is one of those issues. When people talk particularly about it from a supermarket perspective, so let's just deal with that whole question for a moment, there is this sensation or comment that the big guys have 80% of the market. That's it. It's actually not true. What we know is that something over 45% of people who shop still buy their fresh fruit, vegetables and meat at a small local store, not at a supermarket. So combined, the big guys only have something like 54% of the marketplace. So you would be surprised that there is in fact an incredibly healthy competitive sector amongst those smaller retailers, and that's really supported by the ACCC report into groceries last year. And even as late as only a couple of weeks ago, Graham Samuel from the ACCC was saying, look, everybody needs to, and I'm paraphrasing slightly, but he did say this, that he thought everybody should have a pecs and a good lie down on the subject of major supermarkets because there is competition in the marketplace. So, I think it's a... The reality is there are still lots and lots and lots of those shops there. Certainly that's the way I shop.
You can't spend weekend on the high street. You can spend a weekend in the mall.
You can, but, you know, that's also about this issue of destination shopping. It's a bit like the butt cam story of earlier. People actually want to shop and have an experience as well. It's not just about going and getting the product going home. And malls, in many instances, provide that experience, in inverted commas, because there's a cinema there and, you know, there's all that buzz and bustle and all the rest of it. So people are looking for different things when they shop in that environment.
Yeah.
Oh, mine is a similar question, but I feel it's becoming dehumanised, you know, the retailing business used to be personal, and you go into these big stores, and you're talking about how you pick a dress and you can go, you're told where to go by a machine. You know, I mean, it worries me that all this personal touch is going.
Yeah, can I say to you that certainly when I talk to my retailers, there is no doubt in their mind that the most critical part of their business are the people who are on the floor. And one of the things that you will see and have seen over the last 12 months is that when we talk about job loss in the sector or changes from full-time to part-time or casual work, the place where the least impact is being felt is on the floor of those stores. They're putting an awful lot of energy and effort into making sure that the people who interact with you when you go into the store, they're there. So a lot of the cuts are actually happening back office arrangements in the big retailers. You know, even though you've got the option to do things like self-serve and all of that stuff at the supermarkets now, which I freely confess I don't do, I go and talk to somebody who puts it through, you will always continue to have those two options. And sorry, if I just make one other point on that score. That's a really interesting thing about some of these specialty approaches to supermarkets that you're seeing in places like Germany. They're taking that level of concern and saying, how do we build customer loyalty? Okay, if what our customers really want is more people interaction, we're just not going to put that technology stuff in here. We will build a different kind of store that works for them. And then I think you're going to see more of that sort of segmentation of the marketplace.
What's the nature of your concern about the planning side of things? There's a lot of trade-offs that have to be made between, you know, the use of the market. Are they not to your advantage?
Not quite certain exactly where you're going with that. From our perspective at the moment, I would have to say here in New South Wales, there is an appetite for change. There is an appetite for conversation with different parts of both retail and other parts of the community that have concerns and issues with parts of the planning system. One of the things that came out of the job summit six months ago, was a commitment from the government to actually set up a special group that would represent each of those sectors to interact directly with the planning department and draw up a schematter of issues that we want to deal with. That group's, I think, had one meeting at this point, so if I can take that on notice, there's about to be some sort of priority list issue for that.
How are you being sold short?
Well, because effectively, A, it takes a great deal of time for us to get from A to B, as I mentioned. You know, 8 years from the point where you identify there needs to be a shop to the point where you can have somebody come through the door. A timing issue. Another issue, so for example, I think as I mentioned with things like Parramatta and Bankstown, that recent discussion, if you actually want competition and cheaper prices, particularly in the supermarket area, you need to have more of them. And at the moment, something like 70% of instances in this country, you have a mix of supermarkets within a certain distance, and it is impacting on prices. What we're saying is that councils have to understand that listening to one or two opponents is not necessarily going to deliver the outcome for the wider group of consumers, which is lower prices, more competition. We're saying it shouldn't be so hard.
Just a final question. As you're probably familiar, the Kaiser Wilhelm said in 1914 that Britain was just the nation of small shopholders, but was the British won the war, or the Allies won the war. How do you think this sort of concept of retail holds up in the global financial crisis? Because, you know, if you look at the United States, there's a view that perhaps the United States shocked itself into trouble because it shocked itself into buying whole lots of imports from China, and that set up in itself a financial problem for the United States. Do you think retail is going to come out of the global financial crisis as it went in, or is it going to change?
Well, I think some of the trends I was talking about before are going to perhaps change the way retail thinks about itself. The fact that people are more cautious about how they spend, that credit card might not be their method of choice when they go into a shop, what are the implications from that perspective in terms of how retailers run their businesses? There's no doubt that smaller retailers have felt great pain during this recession. But at the other end of the spectrum, you see people doing remarkably clever things. And I can tell one anecdote about a famous designer here in Australia, whose clothes I buy lots of. I looked at the collection 12 months ago and it was filled with paper taffeta. I thought, what is that about? And she said to me, she's been in the business now for 30 years. She's seen two recessions, and she knew that during that period, for her designs to continue to make good money, she had to appeal to a slightly different market. So brides who could no longer afford to go out and spend thousands and thousands and thousands of dollars on frock to indoor frocks went and bought something for half that price from her designer collection because she was smart enough to figure out that that was going to be a hole in the marketplace over the next 12 months. So there's really clever changes happening from that point of view. But in terms of long term, I think things like the payment method, the loss perhaps of a number of smaller stores, a change to the attitude in terms of how you hold loyalty and valuing customer loyalty going forward. And I think this whole question of how is that Generation X and Y actually feeling? How scared have they been by this exercise? And when we talk about a return to confidence, are we talking about a return to confidence in an old-fashioned descriptor without really understanding what confidence means for that group? Now, how they feel about their future, their job, and their willingness to spend, I think is going to colour a lot of how retail redesigns itself.
Thanks. Many thanks to Margie for coming along tonight. Margie Osman runs an important association, and retail plays a huge role in the Australian economy, as we've witnessed over the last 12 months and well into the future. So for tonight, coming along and talking about what's happening to retail, thanks for that. The Sydney papers will be up on our pod tomorrow, and no doubt we'll have you back in the future as the analysis of the economic circumstances goes on. And as you know, the Sydney issue we've been focusing a bit this year on the financial crisis and its implications. But for tonight, well done. Thanks.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.